chapter 16, verse 2. Sa uttarasya tanayam upayema iravatim janame jaya dims chaturas tasyam utpadaya sutan. Uttarasya of King Uttara, Tanayam, daughter Upayeme, married Iravatim, Iravati, Janame Jayadin, headed by Maharaj Janamajaya, Chatura, four, Tasyam, in her, Utpadayat, begot Sutan, sons. Translation, King Parikshit married the daughter of King Uttara and begot four sons headed by Maharaj Janamajaya. Purport, Maharaj Uttara was the son of Virata and maternal uncle of Maharaj Parikshit. Iravati, being the daughter of Maharaj Uttara, was the cousin sister of Maharaj Parikshit, but cousin brothers and sisters were allowed to get married if they did not belong to the same gotra or family. In the Vedic system of marriage, the importance of gotra or family was stressed. Arjuna also married Subhadra, although she was his maternal cousin sister. Janamajaya, one of the Rajarsi kings and the famous son of Maharaj Parikshit. His mother's name was Iravati, or according to some, Madravati. Maharaj Janamajaya begot two sons of the names Gatanika and Sankukarna. He celebrated several sacrifices in the Kurukshetra pilgrimage site, and he had three younger brothers named Srutasena, Ugrasena, and Bhimasena too. He invaded Takshala, Ajanta, and he decided to avenge the unlawful curse upon his great father Maharaj Parikshit. He performed a great sacrifice called Sarpa Yagya to kill the race of snakes, serpents, including the Takshaka, which had bitten his father to death. On request from many influential demigods and sages, he had to change his decision to kill the race of snakes. But despite stopping the sacrifice, he satisfied everyone concerned in the sacrifice by rewarding them properly. In the ceremony, Mahamuni Vyasadeva also was present, and he personally narrated the history of the Battle of Kurukshetra before the king. Later on, by the order of Vyasadeva, his disciple Vaisampayana narrated before the king the subject matter of Mahabharata. He was much affected by his great father's untimely death and was very anxious to see him again. And he expressed his desire before the great sage Vyasadeva. Vyasadeva also fulfilled his desire. His father was present before him, and he worshipped both his father and Vyasadeva with great respect and pomp. Being fully satisfied, he most munificently gave charities to the brahmanas present at the sacrifice. Translation: King Parikshit married the daughter of King Uttara and begot four sons headed by Maharaj Janamajaya. So in the Bhagavatam, like other Puranas and other scriptures, there's often a discussion or description of the genealogy, which is, in one sense, we find a little boring. So-and-so begot so-and-so, so-and-so begot so-and-so, so-and-so begot so-and-so. And we'll find that later also in 8th and 9th cantos, also a huge list of genealogies. But that's not uncommon in scriptures, and not only in scriptures, but in epics, even in mundane work, sometimes we find this long list of line of kings or whatever, which is useful because we can trace out history to some degree that by these lists. In any case, the genealogy is important as far as Bhagavatam is concerned, because the line of kings were the descendants of Manu, and they were the authorized persons to rule the earth. So there was, and they were also empowered by the Supreme Lord to do so. They're not Shaktivesh avatars because they don't have eternal spiritual bodies, but they get some power by the Lord to carry out their activities, just as the devatas and the great sages are called vibhutis of the Lord also, and they have special powers for a certain period of time. So the Manus have been arranged by the Lord to govern our earth planet. If we look in the second canto of Bhagavatam, there it describes that the Bhagavatam has 10 topics. Of course, it's not unique to Bhagavatam. Any major Purana generally has 10 topics, similar topics. So in other words, they all have the same theme, of which Sarga, Visarga, Sthana are there. That is creation, sub-creation, and geography, etc. So you'll find these common themes in the Puranas. And one of the themes is Manvantara. So this is therefore a topic in the Puranas to go through the describe the different Manus and their reigns, 14 in one day of Brahma, and particularly from Swayambhuva onward. Then they start tracing the line, Manus, descendants, etc., which will be done from third canto onwards also. So in this way, the topic is there as a part of the Purana. And so in Bhagavatam we'll have discussion of genealogies, etc. So this is important because the Lord does not abandon the material world after creating it. We know that the Lord is independent and untouched by material nature. So even if he creates the material world, he's in no way contaminated by it. He is not subject to the gunas. He's not subject to karma. So how does he manage this world if he's so detached from it? So he makes different arrangements. One, of course, is that he is Paramatma in the heart of every jiva. So therefore he can witness everything of all jivas. Of course, he does that in a detached way also. Another way is through the Manus and their descendants. He manages the earth through his representatives. Of course, we have the devatas above the earth, and they are supplying things, and this is the way the Lord manages. And then he has the Manus, who are particularly managing this earth and establishing dharma for the human beings. So in this way, the Lord has some control over the planet and the creation after he's created it, even though he doesn't directly interfere he empowers these individuals to establish a system by which the human beings can live peacefully on the earth. So that system is called Dharma. As I mentioned previously, the king has to establish Dharma, but Dharma doesn't exist by itself for long periods of time unless we also have bhakti or devotion there. So the king is not only an establisher of Dharma, he's also a devotee of the Lord, so he also establishes bhakti. Of course, it's not everybody participates in the bhakti so much, more they're just like any society, they're interested in surviving and living and getting material enjoyment, etc. So, nevertheless, the opportunity is there for spiritual advancement also. So the king is responsible for both things, Dharma, the regular Dharma, Varnashram system, and Bhakti. Okay. So in this way, the Bhagavatam shows that the Supreme Lord is not indifferent to the jivas within this material world. There is a problem, of course, because we see at the beginning of the creation of Brahma, he creates all the nice things. Narada Muni's there, the great sages, etc., and Manu, etc. But we also see that at the beginning of the creation, it's also these demons that come out of Brahma. and we see there's a whole lineage of demons manifesting, and some of them become very powerful. We get the whole race of Daityas coming from Diti later on. We have a system established by the Lord, but because of nature of gunas and the nature of karma and the nature of jivas, we do have a bad element within the material world, and that reflects in the human population also. So we get lots of conflict between the establishment of Dharma by Manu and his descendants, and then we get the opposing elements like the bad kings, etc., like Kamsa and Jarasandha and Sishupal, etc. So we get this friction also coming out, which is also expressed in one of the topics of the Bhagavatam called Uti, which means the tendencies of the jivas. So we have the two tendencies, the good and the bad, the daiva or the devata, the devotee type, and the demon, the asura type. So then we get conflict as a result of that. So though the Manu has established a nice system empowered by the Lord, then we get opposition to the system also. And that's exactly what we see in the Bhagavatam, why Krishna appears. He appears because of Kamsa and all his supporters. These are the demonic elements disturbing the system of Dharma. That's how Krishna came, and he spent a lot of time killing demons. We find even after, then Krishna kills the demons, then he disappears. And then we see the rise again of the demons. Kali Yuga starts. And here we get, they said that actually Duryodhana was the personification of Kali, who came a little early and it caused a big disturbance. And Duryodhana was like previous incarnation of Kali personified. And then we get here in the this chapter, Parikshit Maharaj, he meets the personification of Kali, just as Kali is about to begin, the age of Kali is about to begin. So after the disappearance of Krishna, then the rise starts again, and then Parikshit, because he's a great devotee of the Lord, he stops this demonic element. But as we see here, the Parikshit's descendants there, Janamanjaya and later on, gradually the influence of the demons becomes stronger and the influence of the kings become weaker. And then we have a whole history of how the whole line disappears eventually, and then the last descendant of Manu runs up in the Himalayas and disappears. So therefore, Kali is very free to enter in, and we get the demonic element becoming very strong in Kali Yuga. So that, but anyway, the Lord makes arrangements at certain times for, in a certain way, for the benefit of the jivas. So one is the manus and their descendants. So here we have the Pandavas on the throne, then Parikshit on the throne, then Janamanjaya on the throne. And that's the one arrangement. The other is the appearance of devotees who are not related to the political structure of the earth and governing or anything. There's free devotee sages. So we have Narada Muni wandering around at all times, preaching and giving advice and giving blessings and encouraging everyone. So we have great sages like that. Some of who are, he's a Sakyavas avatar. And then we have other devotees of the Lord also. As I explained, that they may not be on the highest level, but the Madhyamadikaris become the preachers, and they're the ones that spread bhakti all over the earth for the common people, uplift them. So this is another way in which the Lord arranges for the benefit of the people of the world and doesn't leave them to suffer. So we have the line of manus and the kings and the management system there, and they're in great devotional example, and then we have the devotees who wander around the earth preaching. So that's the a second way in which it is done. So anyway, as far as the manus are concerned, this is one topic of the Bhagavatam. It's part of the structure by which the Lord maintains an equilibrium in the world and makes sure that the demonic force doesn't get too strong. The empowered representatives of the Lord are there to keep order within the universe. And in this way, there is an arrangement made by the Supreme Lord. And so that is one topic of the Bhagavatam. And therefore, we will get the genealogies described. So every day of Brahma, we'll get the same series of manus appearing, but it's different personalities, different jivas, but they get the same name and they carry out the same functions more or less. And then within the different manvantara periods, then we get the appearance of the different avatars, like the lila avatars coming out as well. So there's another way in which the Lord gives benefit to the people of the earth in spite of being, you know, neutral or whatever. So he comes as avatar, and then he gives teachings, he inspires the jivas, etc. He destroys the demons and carries out many functions for the welfare of the people. There's another way in which the Lord gives benefit to their avatar, in the form of avatars. One avatar came, that was Krishna. And then he disappeared. So after the disappearance of the avatar, generally there is a big disappointment. There's a lack felt. When the Supreme Lord disappears, obviously. And similarly with the great devotee, when a great devotee disappears, then everyone becomes completely mournful and grief-stricken, etc. So, and there's a big absence caused by the, a lack felt by the people because of his absence. So in the case of Krishna disappearing, Maharaj Yudhisthira and his brothers decided they would disappear also. And then they left Parikshit there all by himself to carry out the whole task of controlling all the rising demonic elements in Kali Yuga. From him it went on to his son and his line, etc. But though that is so, there's another way in which things get preserved. And this question was asked by the sages of Naimisharanya. And now that Krishna's disappeared, how is Dharma going to continue? So the answer is given. The Bhagavatam has arisen. So scripture is another way in which there's a continuation of the, maintenance of Dharma and Bhakti in the material world. So even if the Lord isn't there, we have the scripture. And for Kali Yuga, what is the scripture? It is Srimad Bhagavatam. So why particular Srimad Bhagavatam is because we see later on, previously actually, the Bhagavatam was specifically written for the people of Kali Yuga. The other Puranas were not specifically for the people of Kali Yuga because they recommended worship of devatas like Shiva or Brahma. So Narada Muni said, this is not proper for the people of Kali Yuga. They're too unintelligent. They're too materially attached. They're confused. They don't know. They can't come to the proper conclusion of scripture. They're short-lived. So you've got to give a very powerful process, a very simple process, a very clear process, and not many choices, only one choice. They said, only worship Krishna. That's the choice. Everybody. Don't choose anything. And because Krishna is most attractive, the people can advance quickly by worshiping Krishna. And even though they're confused and materially delusioned, because Krishna is so attractive, they can still get benefit. So I told the story of how Shishupala, of course, hated the Lord, so he was a demon. But because Krishna was so attractive, he concentrated on Krishna. So he got great benefit, even from his hatred. Because Krishna was so attractive. Krishna's name was attractive, and Krishna's form was attractive. So this is the solution for the people of Kali Yuga. In spite of everything else being bad or whatever, and the line of Manus has disappeared, we have saving grace there. So we have Krishna in the form of the Bhagavatam. So that's the value of the Bhagavatam. It presents Krishna to us. And even though Krishna disappeared, Krishna is present in the Bhagavatam, and this will, worship of Krishna through the Bhagavatam will give the greatest benefit to all the people of Kali Yuga. There's another way in which the Lord does not abandon the material world, but keeps it going. So that's the main topic of Bhagavatam, but because it is a Purana, then it has all these 10 topics in it, including the genealogies and Manus and all this as well. So therefore we get a tracing the lineages throughout the work here. So here we have the Pandavas, their heir is Parikshit. Parikshit has four sons, of which Janamanjaya was the chief son, so he became the king. And then his descendants go on like this. So in this way, the lineage continues for some time, in spite of the fact that Kali Yuga is fast approaching. So this is the why we get all these details of lineages, etc., in the Bhagavatam. So we find here that Janamanjaya, as the king, one of his famous incidents is trying to kill all the snakes. So he had a sacrifice to kill all the snakes, and because his father was killed by one of the snakes, Takshaka, so he wanted to take revenge for his father. So in general, we know that such things, devotees don't bother with taking revenge or whatever. But we do find incidences like this. We had Pritchard himself. He got insulted because the Brahmana ignored him when he wanted some water. So he put a snake around his neck. And then the son of the Brahma cursed him. So here we have Janamanjaya being very, very upset by the way in which his father died, and so therefore he took revenge on the snakes and wanted to kill all the snakes, and it started a big sacrifice. But we see that ultimately he stopped that. He listened to the sages and the devatas, and therefore he followed their advice. So we see that he was willing to follow again the advice of the sages, the brahmanas. So that shows his quality as a king. So he was still qualified in spite of the fact that he did something like starting to kill all the snakes. Still, he was willing to listen, so he stopped that activity. So in this way, the kings had special qualities to rule the earth because of their empowerment by the Supreme Lord. So they had great knowledge of Dharma, how to handle people in the material world in a very just way, in which they could be satisfied materially, and at the same time help them advance spiritually. And as well as that, then they were great devotees of the Lord, so they understood that ultimately the people had to be led beyond Dharma and take to the process of bhakti as a superior process. So that balance was there in the ideal kings. Sometimes we see the kings didn't have that balance properly and they got a little bewildered, but in general this was the system. So as long as that was intact, then we have a proper rulership. So this chapter is particularly about Parikshit and his management of the kingdom in spite of the fact that Kali Yuga was fast approaching. So he became a great example of how to manage in a very difficult situation. He was able to maintain his kingdom properly because of his great qualification as a knower of Dharma, plus being a great devotee of the Lord. Okay, any questions?
And you get a god, and of course we have it. We will sometimes think that that king was Dhruva Maharaj, he goes there and kills all people, and the majority of all people is nice. So they have the free will to do their own thing. So does Krishna appoint them, and then he has to rectify when they use their free will in a way that it's not really suited for the area that they govern? Or he just kind of lets the
Let the atmosphere be great according to their free will
of the kings, or the free will of the kings, or does Krishna keep the king? There's a topic about Bhagavatam Purana, when they do the maintenance, Purana. Bhoshana. That's protection. Protection. When he protects the planet, or when he does the maintenance of the planet, is it done according to the way Krishna wants, or is it for the money, or is it done that you put the king in charge and then
So it's like a little careful balance there. We have the system set up by the Lord, and then we have the free will of the jiva. And of course, the jivas maybe have some conditioning, so they may make mistakes or whatever. So that is taken into account also. We see some cases it gets extreme where King Vena got in charge and the Brahmanas had to kill him, etc. And then they had to think of how to continue the line, so they produced Prithu Maharaj to continue the line. So the Lord doesn't interfere with the free will of the jivas, and if the mistakes are there, then there is some sort of safeguard, or we could say a safety switch there, in the sense that if he's a good king, he'll listen to higher authority. The sages, in this case the sages and the devatas, in the case of also of Dhruva, he would listen to some council, higher authority, because he was a good king. If he was a bad king, he'll just do his own thing, like Vena. They tried to, the Brahmanas tried to preach to him, he wouldn't listen. So if he's a good king, then he will get, that safeguard is there, that he takes the counsel of the Brahmanas and the sages, and therefore if they think he's doing something wrong, then he'll follow their advice and make some correction like that. So that was inbuilt into the system itself. So the ideal king was a combination of rajas and sattva, not just rajas. So because of the sattvic element, he has a tendency to listen to the brahmanas, to give respect to authority, to give respect to the scriptural things like this, because of sattva. That's what sattva does. You accept your astika, you accept this authority of the scripture. So, and you have a little bit of detachment from your position, so you're not completely absorbed in power. So that balance should be there within an ideal kshatriya, that he's not completely passionate about controlling everything. And he has a respect for a higher authority. Also, in some detachment from his job, and he's doing his responsibility only, rather than just trying to control everybody for his own purposes. So that's a safeguard. Of course, we see that we get exceptional cases where it doesn't work. If we get King Raina coming out of there, and they had to do away with him. And then we have Kali Yuga, where nobody was qualified as a leader, because there's no empowered person to carry on. So the other safeguard was the empowerment by the Lord also, that he would give them special abilities so they be intelligent, do it real properly. But now we don't have that. Have a Satya Yuga instead of a Kali Yuga. Well, there's no scriptural, reason why he appeared then, in one sense, as far as I know, but we can give an explanation, is that he appears at the end of Kali Yuga, end of Dwarpa Yuga rather than the beginning, so that it's closer to Kali Yuga, and the influence can be there, closer he is. And then the other point is that in Kali Yuga, then we get the Yuga avatar Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appearing, who is none other than Krishna. So it's like Krishna appearing after that. So there's a proximity there, because Krishna appeared, then he appears again in another form of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, with he's also Swayam Bhagavan. So he's not like a, as I said, with the powers of Rama or Narsimhadeva or some percentage. He's actually the same as Krishna. So it's an extension of Krishna and Kali Yuga in the form of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Now, the yugas are prearranged, and nobody changes the yugas. They go on inevitably time and time again, for 1,000 times in the day of Brahma. So we get Satya, Treta, Dwarpa, Kali, and there's no interference in that system in the general sense. So therefore, in Kali Yuga, after Dwarpa, then we have to get a degradation. We start out with Satya, which is very nice. We get Treta Yuga with a little bit of imperfection. We have Dwarpa Yuga with more imperfection, and then we get Kali Yuga with mostly imperfection, mostly faults and sins and whatever. So that's the general cycle of time. Why it's like that? It's simply to illustrate the fact that this is the nature of the material world, degradation. So we get an object, and after 10 years, it's gone. It's not, it breaks. It's no good anymore. And a tree, no matter how long it lasts, eventually it dies. Bodies die. So in bigger cycles, we have sattvic society, and gradually it goes into tamasic society, like this. So the tendency in the material world is towards destruction and tamagun. So the Lord keeps countering that by producing satyayuga. Then it declines and declines and declines, and enough sin, Kali Yuga again. Like, then, very mercifully, he raises the whole thing up and declines again like this. So this is the his injection of something into the nature of the prakriti of degradation by putting it in a high position, but then it goes down again. So then he puts it up again, down again. It's inevitable that these things will happen. So in spite of that, the Lord gives mercy in all of the yugas, including Kali Yuga, so he comes as Yuga avatar there to establish a process by which we can get mercy and develop spiritually in spite of the fact it's the worst. So we have Kali Yuga avatar for that purpose. So there's no way of interfering with the system, but nevertheless we have Krishna appearing at the end of that Dwapara Yuga so that he can influence Kali Yuga, which is right next to it. But then we have Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appearing to preach about Krishna and make Krishna accessible to the people of Kali Yuga so that he can be delivered. Because the whole idea of Bhagavatam is that Krishna is the person that everyone should worship. He is the ultimate person. But difficult to understand, therefore we have Bhagavatam. Even so, a little difficult for people to really realize. So therefore we have Nam Sankirtan also, name of Krishna. That makes it much easier for people to approach Krishna. So, in spite of the fact that it's all degraded or whatever, still the Lord makes arrangements so that Krishna can manifest himself in Kali Yuga through Bhagavatam and Nam Sankirtan.
You're just talking about the progression of the yugas, and in the fourth chapter of the first canto, Prabhupada mentions that the order is actually
reversed.
Gopala, Treta, and then Kali. And then in the account of the 28th millennium or something, the Bible chart, there's an overlapping there for the order of reversal of the second and the third, meaning Sakya, Treta, Gopala. So what I'm wondering is when the yugas in their normal state, you know, Sakya, Gopala, Treta, Kali, does that mean that the Yuga Dharma also is consistent, like, you know, the Yuga Dharma for the Gopara Yuga will stay the same, and then the different avatars will come?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's one explanation like that is a little unique because it's very difficult to figure out how it would happen. You know, if we reverse everything, does that mean the length of time also goes different? And then do the qualities go different? And then do the yuga avatars reverse? But we don't see that description anywhere of how that happens. Yeah? And we also don't find, if you look in the commentaries, they don't talk about any reversal also. So my interpretation of this is the word used there, I think, is paryaya. So paryaya can mean a succession, one yuga going to the next yuga, or it can also mean a reversal in some cases. So I think Prabhupada took it as a reversal, but it could also be a succession. So most people don't talk about a reversal, just succession. And other places we don't see that reversal explained in any way. Yeah, well, I think maybe it's because of that, the word paryaya, which means reversal also, but also means succession, so it means both things. Yeah. Manu?
Yeah.
Oh, well, he's one of the first creations of Lord Brahma, Manu. That's Swayambhuva Manu. Yeah? And then he has his descendants, and we get Dhruva in that line in the third canto, and Priyavrata and others in that line. So that's that they are people with bodies, material bodies, etc., but they're empowered by the Lord to rule over the earth. Yeah? And they continue. The line continues for 71 yuga cycles, which is 4 million something years by 71. And there's 14 cycles, so 14 manus reign, and their descendants reigning in one day of Brahma, like that, which makes 1,000 yuga cycles total. So after the first 71, then another person takes charge, another manu, he gets appointed. And then his descendants start, and he goes for 71 yuga cycles like that. Yeah. Some of them are related to the first line of Manu also. Some are separate like that. Yeah. And then we go up to the day of Brahma. We're now in the seventh cycle of Manus, Vaivasvata Manus here. Yeah. And then we're in the 28th cycle of this one, and that's when Krishna appears. And Vyasadeva appears in the 28th cycle within this. So they are, just like the Devatas, their posts. And the devatas also last for 71 yuga cycles. All the devatas, and then suddenly they're finished, and another set of jivas enter those posts, and another Indra is there, and another Surya or whatever, they're all 14 times in one day of Brahma. So along with the devatas, we get the Manu's also changing in the same way. So they're empowered by the Lord to rule over properly, and they rule over, the Manu's rule over the earth sphere.
So all the bodies or personalities come from the main constant, and the new jivas come into those bodies?
Well, not exactly the personalities, we can say the post, it's the post. And then along with the post, Krishna empowers them, gives them extra little power to do their job nicely, give them special abilities, yeah? Or encourage their abilities or whatever, stimulates their abilities to rule and whatever they have to do. Yeah.
Maybe it's my question,
but... And then the next day of Brahma, then we have someone called Swayambhuva Manu, but it's a different jiva again. And then we have the Manus in the next day of Brahma, also the same names in the same sequence, but they're different jivas put in those posts.
Yes, I'm guessing everything with the material body has to take energy or eat food of some sort, and what about the higher bodies, what kind of habit?
What do the devatas eat? Yeah, I suppose everything eats, but they have less, they're not so grossly dependent as we are. Like we're dependent on water and oxygen and food and whatever like this, and we have to struggle to get all these things, you know, on earth. So as you go higher and higher and higher, there's less of that problem. And so that's why the day in Svargaloka, they're much nicer. You don't have to struggle like that. You don't have to age. You have long periods, long lifespans, etc. like that. No struggle for food or whatever like that. Of course, they say they do eat. So soma is their drink, special drink there. Okay? So that enlivens them, I guess. So obviously, they have enjoyment, so therefore they have food of some sort or whatever like that, but it's not like our gross food, whatever. And then we go up until Brahma, and that's a very, very subtle, very, very subtle sphere with all the inhabitants there getting there who live long periods of life, like anything. And this has hardly any suffering, birth, death, old age, hunger, thirst, nothing. There's hardly very little trace of that at all. So it's hard to conceive of because the bodies are so different. But and you can say they're living in a different dimension almost. You know? So hard for us to conceive of. So they're Their sustenance is much different. They're not dependent like we are on the gross elements.
I've heard not from Shastra or from another source that in the higher bodies there comes a point where your thought forms become your food. So like the things you think then become things.
Can. Of course, when you get the spiritual world, then everything is like it's all very free. Whatever you think is the reality like that. But you can see even in higher planets, then they have great abilities like this. So the thinking and the whatever is able to manifest things also there. Like yogis can manifest things with their thoughts. So higher planets also they can do similar things.
And just one more question on Manu. So Manu is residing on the planet now?
He's in one of the Varshas, the present. He's not here, but generally it describes how the previous Manu, I think, was on one of the Varshas, I think upper Varshas in our Bhumandala. Not our Varsha, but another Varsha. Well, there's a little island called Jambudweep with the Mount Meru in the middle, and then it's divided into sections divided by mountain ranges. So one of them is Bharat Varsha, that's where we are, and then we can't go to the next Varsha, I think it's Kimpurusha Varsha, like this, or Hari Varsha, like this, and then up at the top there's another three, and in the middle there's the mountain, and the two Varshas on the side. So we have nine varshas, or nine sections of this island. And we're only in one section. We can't go to the next section. That's called Jambudweep.
You would say that it's a different wavelength, maybe?
Slightly different. It's all earth sphere, so it's less than the heavenly planets. So these other places are called Bhoma Svarga. They're like heavenly planets in one sense, you know, because there's less problems than our particular Bharat Varsha. Nevertheless, they're not as high as the Svarga sphere where they live long periods of time. So they're on a lower level, but they're comparatively better than our planet, our Varsha here. So it's called heavenly.
Yeah, it's also in relation to Kayaguan. But I was reading how when his son Priyavrata, he wanted him to get married and he did not. Mm. So the whole story is that Rama had to come down, and I was trying to locate which area was that, if it was on planet Earth or it was...
Yeah, somewhere on Earth. I don't know which. Doesn't mention particularly what Varsha it is. Also, it was very long ago, at the beginning of the day of Brahma.
But it was in Manasatara Mountain.
Oh, it's Manasatara Mountain. Then that's up in the what we would call the Himalayas now. No, Manasatara Mountain Range is that the one going around? There's this huge circle out there. The Manasatara Mountain Range. That's the one that's way out there, and we can't even get there. it's after a few islands out there and a few oceans and whatever, and then there's a Manasatara Mountain Range out there. If that's it, then it's quite far away. We could never get there.
Then I was thinking how Priyavrata, he was not happy. That's how the mandala came in place, because he wasn't happy with the circulation of the sun, so he went with the chariot and he created
the dvipas.
So I'm trying to understand. So what was the mandala before? It was all prepared.
It would appear to be it was different. We didn't have the ocean troughs there and the islands. It was all one flat surface. So quite different from what we see it now. So what I guess is in the Bhagavatam is something that just evolved later on with the central dvipa with Mount Meru and then the other islands and the oceans like that. So somehow Priyavrata created, but that's the beginning of the day of Brahma almost, so it's quite early in it also.
He was like a giant or something.
Must have been. he could produce the oceans. So obviously special powers, they're not limited like we are, because he could make these huge troughs with his chariot and huge oceans, which are so huge that I don't know how many thousands of miles across they are each. Well, whatever. Yeah, it's bigger, twice as big as the last one. Yeah, so they're huge, very huge. So he was able to do that, so he was a remarkable person, obviously.
So when you refer to the earth, you're referring to
Bhumandala,
that we're on.
Yeah, it's the whole thing. Yeah, it's called the Bhumandala. Yeah, Bhumandala. Yeah.
And it's our Varsha, the only human Varsha,
the other ones. They have human people there, whatever, and Hanuman is on one worshipping Rama and this and that, whatever. So, and then on the different dvipas, then we also have kings ruling as well. So they're humanish forms, but probably not exactly our type of body, much better than ours because they're, like Boma Svarga, they're also like almost like devatas there, so they may not be so gross as us.
And each Varsha is a globe?
No, it's a strip of land surrounded by mountains. So you can't go to the next place.
It's like a
circle
dimension, isn't it?
Looks like it, yeah. So, can't go there. Our bodies are limited, so we can't get into that next place, which is almost like heaven, but it's below. It's on the earth sphere, but it's like heaven. Okay. Hare Krishna.